Today on Backroom Politics, it's the day after the inauguration. Washington's starting to recover from the hangover. We're going to talk about the liberal agenda put out by the president in his inaugural address. Also, the fiscal cliff 2.0 still looms heavy over Washington, D.C. and the rest of the country. We'll talk with special guest, former Comptroller General of the United States, Mr. Chuck Bowser. This and Tell Me a Story Today on Backroom Politics.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with your moderator, Justin Russell. To join the political discussion today, you can call toll-free at 877-662-3713. And now, with the roundtable, your moderator, Justin Russell.
Hey, good afternoon out there in political radio land. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me as they do every week, he is the former representative representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the Congressman Al Swift. How you doing, Congressman?
You caught me with my mouth full of water.
Water. Very good. Very good. To his left, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, who's worked for, at last count, four presidents. He is a former longtime Senate staffer and a very distinguished fellow at the Simpson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Justin, hello. Happy day after inauguration day.
Oh, yes. We'll get to that in a second. But to my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for then Majority Leader Gerald R. Ford. He is a former vice president of government affairs for NBC. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Justin. It's good to be here the day after the inaugural, and I wasn't arrested at the parade yesterday.
That's good. That's good. You weren't up in a tree yelling. We'll talk about that, though. And to my 1 o'clock, he is the former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is longtime Washington insider. He is Carl Toobin. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Justin. Nice to be here. Inaugural day plus one.
Exactly. And our special guest on the roundtable today, he is the former Comptroller General of the United States under Ronald Reagan, served many years in that capacity, and now Washington insider. He is Chuck Bowser. Chuck, how you doing? Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks. It's always great to be back here at Shelley's Tavern and be with you guys.
Oh, thank you. We love having you. It's always good to have somebody other than Alan has facts behind him. It's always good. And having you on the show obviously gives us credibility. Look, here's the great thing
which
about...
we can really use.
Exactly. Here's the great thing about today. If you're a career service employee with the federal government, it's a work day. If you're a political appointee, it's a hangover. It is day plus one after the inauguration of President Barack Obama's second term. Washington is starting to clean up, recover from the large weekend party that we just had. Lots of stuff going on, but we want to start real quickly. There's breaking news coming out of Houston, Texas. There are, at last count, three wounded at Lone Star College, just northeast of Houston, Texas. Two gunmen, one has been shot. One is in custody. The details are still coming out about that. This after a long week of at last count four pieces of gun violence out there across the United States. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the president's agenda. But let's first things first, we're going to talk a little bit about the president's agenda, the inauguration, and all things happening in D.C. I'm going to start, since it was a Democratic president who started his second term, Congressman Al, you saw the inaugural speech. You saw the inauguration.
I did.
It was many people calling it just a liberal piece of rhetoric going out from the president.
Who's calling it that?
Oh, Fox News.
I was going to say, to conservatives, I can see why they would say that.
What did you think?
Well, I thought that, first of all, the things he cited as needing to be done are almost irrefutably things that need to be done. The disagreement between the parties is more how to do them. for example, the Democrats don't disagree that you got to get a handle on spending and the budget and so forth. We disagree on how. So in terms of what he said he wanted to address, I don't know that was particularly liberal. I think he was addressing the issues of our time. Now, how he will address them, the hints were pretty clearly on the liberal side. I liked it.
You did. Alan Moore, from the conservative side, what did you think of the president's speech?
I thought it was a good speech, but not a great speech. I thought some of the soaring rhetoric was very appropriate. The quotes about the Declaration of Independence, I thought that was moving, appropriate stuff for an inauguration. I thought other aspects of the speech, though, were more like a State of the Union speech, where he got into some of the specifics. One of the areas, of course, where he was not specific in the campaign or in the speech was with regard to the deficit. Maybe we disagree, maybe we don't. The president in the campaign, the president in his speech, has never said much of anything about how he intends to tackle this question of the deficit. That is the biggest issue, the biggest problem, the biggest challenge facing this country, and we heard almost nothing about that.
Carl Toobin, you seem to have your finger on the pulse of the Democrats. You agree with Alan, or what's your take on the speech?
My take is that the 18-minute speech is going to go down as one of the best in history. It's going to take time. It's going to have to sink in. But I think he laid out his agenda. He also laid out a tone of trying to people work together and come together and cooperate. He said either in the inaugural or in the luncheon, you know, some we disagree, but let's find a way to agree. And I think that was an important point. Some people are saying Reagan introduced a conservative agenda and for the future, and Obama enunciated the liberal vision for the future.
Well, there's a lot of people the day after they're now saying that Barack Obama, as you stated, could be the liberal Reagan, the liberal footprint for the way the liberal track will go in the future. Chuck Bowser, you've been privy to several inaugurations in your time in D.C. What do you think about him setting that liberal footprint?
Well, I think he did that. I think people are saying that it's the Reagan, like Reagan, you know, to the conservatives, this was to the liberals. I agree that he laid it all out. But at the same time, I can agree with Alan over here, he's never really laid out how we finance it all and how we deal with this huge debt that mostly he inherited. But the debt is there and it's growing, and we cannot continue to have to sell bonds close to $10 trillion, really over $10 trillion if you include the agency debt from Freddie and Fannie, because that's more than the GNP of any other country but ourselves. So we're in a big financial hole, and we've got to have a plan now to start to deal with that. And so far, I don't think the president has ever made the key speech, which explains to the American people, how did we get here, and what do we have to do to deal with it?
I mean, Congressman, now when you look at the speech that the president gave yesterday, it almost sounded like a rejuvenated president, somebody who's definitely got the bully pulpit, you know, wrapped his arms around the bully pulpit, and that he's basically setting the mark for what some have said could be his legacy in his second term. You agree with that?
Well, yes, but then people attach the word legacy to all kinds of things. I thought it was a good combination of the standard inaugural speech, which is a lot of emotion and patriotism and so forth, and partly State of the Union in laying out an agenda. The agenda seemed to me to be a perfectly sensible one. I didn't see where he missed any big item. Now, he has not talked about, I completely agree with my Republican friends here, that he has not addressed in specifics
the budget problem. He's referred to it a lot.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that here coming up shortly. But I do also want to talk about, you know, when you look at some of the quotes, you know, that the president brought out, one of the big ones that he said, and I'm quoting President Obama, our time is standing pat of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. Alan, that's a pretty bold statement coming from a president that everybody is waiting. Where was the message in his first term? Is he setting his message?
Not with those words. There's no there. I mean, I'm not trying to pick on the speech in a big way. I thought, as I said, that it was a good speech. I thought there was also some unnecessary politicking in the speech that sounded like kind of the afterglow of the campaign. He took some shots that he didn't need to take. We talked about takers. Made references to how we don't need to choose between taking care of the elderly and investing in our kids. Well, those are straw men that he didn't need. He made an extraordinary comment about how a decade of war is now over. Well, fine, but let's tell the Afghanis who are dying, the Syrians who are dying, the people in Mali, the people in Algeria. This is a nasty, difficult war and world, and we are going to be fighting terrorists all of our lives. So maybe we don't have to go to war in a conventional sense. So I just thought there were some unnecessary things. I do want to say, Carl made reference to the speech at the lunch, which I thought was magnificent. It was a toast that the president gave. He didn't have a teleprompter. He didn't refer to his notes. He was generous. He was bipartisan.
Genuine.
He was embracing, and he came across in a way that he doesn't normally do. I really, really want to see more of him in a practiced but unscripted way, because I thought that was the best.
Bob Hines.
I think the same. I agree with what everybody said about the address, but I agree 100% with Alan. If the president would not sound all the time like he did in the speech when he lays out his agenda, which I thought is extremely extensive and probably impossible to do, given he's got about 2 years before he's a lame duck, as most second-term presidents are. But at that luncheon, talking to the congressional membership, talking to the people he's going to have to work with in order to get anything done, he sounded like somebody who wanted to solve problems. He talked like to somebody the way you talk to some people when you want to bring them together with you. Maybe they disagree with you, but you ought to be able to find some ground together. And he sounded like he wanted to find ground. I wish he'd do more of that and less of just making campaign speeches about what the wonderful agenda of the Democrats has.
Congressman Al.
I just can't let it go by without noting that Mitch McConnell also joined this gentleness and kindness and what have you by not suggesting that the Republicans' goal is to see that the president doesn't get a third term. While everybody was talking and the commentators on the air were also kind of saying this is a little partisan. I have never heard such vilification come out of a party over a brand new president as happened 4 years ago. The fact that he even talks to them, I think, is amazing.
Alan Moore.
Sorry to be the bearer of facts here, but Al has once again confused what happened 4 years ago with what happened 2 years ago. Mitch McConnell's comment about the top priority being to prevent the re-election of the president came after the midterm elections, after the huge Republican gains. It did not come 4 years ago.
And this makes it more pleasant. This makes it more friendly. This makes him a pal of the president. That's what we were talking about, and that's what I was pointing to.
Carl Toobin.
Yeah, but 4 years ago at the Capitol Grill, the Republican leadership of the House, Cantor and others, got together and said, how can we do, what should our outlook be to make this person a one-term president? And they decided that they were going to say no, 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 and that's exactly what they did.
Alan Moore.
Well, we don't need to relitigate that. There were a lot of mistakes made by this president early on in our collective judgment. We've talked about it ad nauseum in the past about opportunities missed to reach across the aisle. It is definitely true that this administration found itself with economic problems that went beyond anything that anyone could imagine, and they were scrambling from day one. But that was then. This is now. What might or might not have happened in the back room of a bar is one thing. I just wanted to clear up the one issue where to get the timeline correct on what Mitch McConnell said. And I think it's not a huge surprise that either party after an election would say one of our top priorities is going to be how do we win next time out? Wow, I'm shocked.
Yeah.
That would be something people would talk about.
What he said.
Congressman Al.
Incredibly offensive remark that Mitch McConnell made. And every time I hear the Republicans complain about anybody except Nancy Pelosi saying bad things about the Republicans, I want to upchuck.
But I mean,
well, I'm glad to see, Al, that we agree upon one person we don't like.
There we go. There we go. Yeah, but when we talk about this, you know, we look at, you know, basically out of that entire 18-minute speech, one sentence came out, and again, quoting President Barack Obama, we must make the hard choices to reduce the cost of health care and the size of our deficit. That got one sentence, and that's going to be something leading in for the next 6 months. Chuck, should he given a little bit more time or at least focus on that point a little bit further?
Well, I'm not sure that he had to do it at this speech, but he's got to do it pretty soon. And he should have done it, I think, in the last year, during the campaign. And I think Bill Clinton did a marvelous job of explaining the math and the budget at the convention. And I think that's when some of the Democrats started to get unified behind the president and that. So I think this is what is really missing, and that is what's caused the problem. I was involved in the New York City fiscal crisis, the first Chrysler loan board, Lockheed one. You know, you always got to figure out how did we get into this financial crisis, and how do we now, what do we have to do to get out? And that's what we've got to come to as part of governing, because we don't want to just automatically go from $16 trillion of debt to $20 trillion in debt and still going higher.
Well, Congressman Al, I refer back to you. I mean, when we look at the timing, when we look at the financial peril that the federal government's in, do you think that, you know, the president is starting to focus on exactly what's got to be done in his realm as president, in his agenda, that will get the fiscal cliff under control but not take away from Medicare and Medicaid?
Yes, I think he is looking for that. I don't know whether that can be found, that particular balance, but I think that is what he's looking for. And I think, at least to start with, and if he's going to bring the Democrats along, he needs to start there. And then maybe get a little more real and a little more real and bring our side along. The problem of bringing the Republicans along is John Boehner's and Mitch McConnell's problem.
But Carl Tugin, when the president makes the quote, again, quoting the president from his inaugural speech yesterday, the commitments we made to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. That is a very direct bar at the opposition. Is that something that you think that is going to make the Republican Party, particularly in the House, come along with him to try and find some solid middle ground?
I think that what he means there is we need to take care of the seniors and also another party talked about children. But the thing is, I think he wants to say, look, we can do certain things with these programs, but these programs have to stay and have to stay in place, not intact, but in place.
But Bob Hines,
of course the programs are going to stay in place. The problem is, that the president, who is the president, and he's reelected, and he's got the bully pulpit, all the things a president has. He's got a new mandate in his mind. That's fine. Then he ought to use it. I'll be real pleased if he does something besides talk about getting people together, sitting people down, and saying, okay, how are we going to solve our deficit problem? And when he does that, he's going to get my support 100%, because Lord knows we've got to do something, and we need to start. It's going to be a hard thing to do, and there's going to be a lot of pain on a number of sides, because everything is going to be on the table. It has to be. So we'll be looking at revenues, as well as we'll be looking at restructuring some of the programs, and we're going to have a lot of trouble doing it, and everybody is going to have to give something.
Alan Moore.
Around this table, one of the areas where I think we have found some agreement over the last year or so is that neither the president nor his opponent, Mitt Romney, did a very good job of treating the American people like adults and spelling out the facts to them of the horrendous financial dilemma as a government that we are in. The president is already licking his wounds over aspects of this tax deal that got done a few weeks ago to head off all the tax cuts, where the Republicans agreed to raising the rate at the top, but the so-called Bush-era tax cuts were made permanent for 98%, 99% of all Americans. And this so-called payroll tax holiday of 2 percentage points suddenly showed up as a take-home pay cut to every American. Was any groundwork laid for that? Was there any kind of conversation? This is something, beware, it's coming down the road? No. And what I think was happening yesterday is the president was trying to say, hey, don't worry, we're going to protect Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But if I'm the Democrats, I would be a little bit wary. The president in the past has shown a willingness to make some changes in the cost of living adjustment, in the possible age of eligibility for Medicare, all things that I think are important to be on the table. But you have to lay some groundwork for those things, in my judgment, not just surprise the folks with them.
When we talk about laying the groundwork, I mean, we're just talking on the fiscal issues. I mean, President Obama was very aggressive in laying the groundwork for a very, some are saying, liberal agenda. You look at what he's talking about with gun control, gay rights. He mentioned, Selma, Alabama, Stonewall, referring to our gay brothers and sisters. There is definitely a strong gay rights agenda being put forth by the president. Is now the time, or was that the venue, Congressman Al, to bring such a strong, aggressive agenda to the front line?
Why not? I mean, it was an opportunity. On the one hand, you're complaining about things he didn't mention, and then you want to justify all the things that he did mention. I don't quite understand that. But he also talked about, and this is something I think that if I were him, I'd lead with this, because I think it may be the area where the Republicans and Democrats can find common ground most easily, and that's in immigration.
Right.
And I think that would be a wonderful thing to start with, because you might find out that some of these guys are friends, and it might be easier to work the harder things than later.
Well, that might be one of the few things that members of both parties, probably not all of them, but at least a good number in both parties, can probably agree on a lot of what might be in an immigration bill. One of the few things I can think of
exactly.
That you might find some bipartisanship.
And then use that as a springboard into the tougher ones.
But Carl Tubin, go ahead.
I think a lot of these things that he said, he set up an agenda. And he understands that not all of this is going to get done in the next 2 or 4 years. But it's an agenda for liberal causes that could be extended into the future.
How so?
Well, if we get through the next 4 years, and the economy keeps improving, and people are making money, the stock market goes up. The stock market went up from 6 to 700 and some in the last 4 years. So when we talk about the economy has gotten better. And if we can push this economy and make it better over the next 4 years, we might be able to reelect another Democrat in the White House and continue the agenda.
But Chuck Mazur, as former Comptroller General, you know, we're hearing people saying, well, the economy's gotten better, we're on the road to recovery. Is that accurate, or do we still have a long way to go and should have been pointed out in the president's agenda?
Well, I think he has often pointed that out. In other words, he never says we've solved the problem and we're in great shape. He always says, you know, I think we're starting to have an economy that's moving in the right direction. And I think it is. In other words, I think we're finally, but it's taken us 4 to 5 years, but we're finally moving, I think, in the right direction. But the two things we got to make sure, we don't fall back. And the second thing is we've got to keep it going. And if you do that, that's a big factor in trying to get your financial house in order.
But you would think with such a fragile tightrope that we're on fiscally here in the federal government and even throughout the economy in the U.S., Congressman Al, it seems like there would be more of an offer from the president to say, look, let us come collectively as opposed to the aggressive agenda of not budging on Medicare, not budging on Medicaid, not talking about taxes, or not talking about tax breaks or continuation.
I didn't think he said not budge. I think he left room for budging in there. He was saying that this... You got to handle these fiscal issues without leaving the elderly and the poor behind. Okay, now, there's a lot of ways to do that, and some of them are maybe pretty good ways, and some of them are probably pretty bad ways. So he didn't get specific in that regard.
Now and more.
He never does.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Bob Hines.
He never does. If he'd ever start saying something about how he is willing to deal with the deficit, we'd be a hell of a lot better off right now. He could have done it years ago, and he didn't do it, and he still isn't doing it.
Congressman Al.
That's a point on which I agree with Bob. I don't understand why the president sometimes is so reluctant to say things that he obviously is going to have to say at some time. I take, for example, the health care bill. I had the idea that the reason he was quiet for so long to begin with was he was going to let the Congress fight about it for a while and then find out what was kind of floating and what wasn't and grab those and lead the way. Never happened. Basically, Nancy Pelosi, whether you like the thing or not, she gets a lot of credit for pushing that thing through. So I think... that Bob is right. You need to start talking about something. I mean, just start talking about the fact that if we're going to keep the same Social Security steps that we've got, and we get old enough so that 80 is your life expectancy, this is just insane.
Well, we're coming up on the break. I'm going to let that be the last word for this segment. We're going to continue this discussion, which is going to lead to our economic discussion. But, Bob, I'll go to you first when we come back. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich. The sandwich named after me. Breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Blog Talk Radio's Back Room Politics. We're going to continue our discussion from the last segment about the inauguration and some of the agendas being put forward by the president. But I want to start off with the economic side of it. We were talking about that in detail in the last segment, but let's focus in on the economy and the agenda pushed or proposed by his second inaugural address. But Bob, you had a comment from last segment.
Yeah, to pick up on what Al said, and Alan as well. You know, nobody, neither party, wants to put out their program. So if the Democrats put out their program, the Republicans will shoot at it. Vice versa is the same thing. The only person who is in a position to call everybody together in a room, the leadership together, both parties, both houses, and say, look, let's talk about some ideas. What do you think, Harry Reid? What do you think, John Boehner? You know, what do you guys think? Let's find a way to do something. Let's get started. Let's start talking about what we can do and what you can do and find some solutions. That's what has to be done. He should have done it 3 years ago. He didn't. Now is about as late as we can hope to get it, because it's not going to be easy to solve, because both sides have very strong views, legitimately so, because the Democrats want to, quote, save the programs and recognize we have to solve the budget deficit. The Republicans want to get the budget done and also want to save the programs, but recognize they've got to change it.
All right, but you know, we're talking a lot about the budget and the fiscal crisis and what's going on, and we've been talking about this for weeks. It's a problem that does not go away. I don't think anybody really knows the true reality of what's going on. Chucky, you probably know as best as anybody about what the current state and what's going on with the budget as we see it. What's the reality?
Okay, I'll tell you what the reality is. And that is that in 2001, we had a $200 billion surplus, and we had a plan to pay down the debt for the next 9 years. And then the Bush-Cheney team came in and did the Bush tax cuts. They didn't expect to be in wars, but they got into wars with no financial plan. So we've had 10 years of war where we've been running up huge deficits, you might say, on the spending for defense and national security. We then did the Part D of the drug part of Medicare with no plan to pay for it. And then they got caught with the financial crisis in 2008, which led us to a lot fewer revenues when we went into a recession. So we know what caused it, and that is the revenue never went up. In other words, it was $2 trillion in 2001 and was $2 trillion a decade later. Now, your spending during the same time went up to $3.5 trillion. And a lot of it is just what I described of why it went up. So now with just what's happened the last couple of years, we're down to where we're short $500 billion or half a trillion on the revenue side and the same on the expense side. So we've got to find out how do you get $500 billion more in the revenue side and how do you get $500 million less spending. And I'll explain it to you.
Please do, because I think there's a, you know, when you watch the 30-second soundbite on the media these days, it almost seems overly simplistic.
Yeah.
That it's just a matter of just, you know, either making a $1 trillion platinum coin and depositing it in a federal bank somewhere. What do we have to do?
We have dug such a big financial hole that it is not simple, but it's doable. In other words, let's take the expenditure side. On Social Security, we have to have a program for the retired people to have a national pension. Every other industrial country has one. We can adjust the Social Security on the tax side, the revenue side, and get more taxes coming in. And we can adjust the inflation factor, and that does a lot for keeping the expenditure down. That's what Nixon, you know, he put in the full indexing of the Social Security, and it really got out of control on him. He recognized that. He said that was the worst decision he made. But we can adjust those two things, and we can get some real savings in Social Security and get that in balance. That's not rocket science. What is the toughest part is health care, because it's not just Medicare and Medicaid. It's the whole American healthcare system, see. In other words, we're spending 17% of GNP heading to 20%. When I was in office and testifying before Congress, we were spending 12, 13 to 15%, and everybody else is spending 9 or 10, see. So we've got to get a modern overall healthcare system reform going, and the seeds of that are in the Obamacare. In other words, if you build on the trying to improve the quality and make the really top-notch medical centers like Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic.
Right.
I go to the Mayo Clinic every year. Once you go to one of these places, you really understand how the modern healthcare system in America should work, see, and that. And so there are cost savings there, but you aren't going to get them in a 12-month period. You're going to have to do that over probably a 10-year period. It's going to be like trying to get on top of the agriculture program, which we did quite well. Then I come to defense. In other words, the American people are tired of these 10-year wars in far-off lands, and we're coming home, just like we did out of Vietnam. And we've got to get back to where defense is 3% of the GNP, not 5%. And when you think about it, in national security, when you had State Department, defense, CIA,
DHS,
security, that's $1 trillion set of costs, and 1.2 million of our civilians in the federal workforce work in that area, and only 800,000 work in all the other areas. See, so this is an area we've got to get control, much like Mel Laird, who was the great Secretary of Defense coming out of the Vietnam War, and I worked for him as a young Assistant Secretary of Navy, why it's doable. In other words, it's very doable. And then you say to the other $500 billion group, that's 25 agencies that are 95%, you say, give us a four-year plan to bring down your costs and everything like that. And pretty soon, you've got a plan of action both on the expenditure side and on the revenue side.
But Chuck, I've heard many people say that we can simplify this by just controlling government growth, limiting it to 2.5% annually, or 3% or 4%.
Yeah.
Is that a realistic
thing? No, that's not realistic, because if you went to say General Motors was in trouble, and we're just going to say in General Motors you just do 2%, then they got to figure out where do they do 2%. In other words, you've got to break it down into the major categories of government programs and government agency, and you've got to deal with what they the areas where they can make real savings.
But Chuck, what we're talking about is, you know, when we hear your version of the reality of the budget and how we got to where we are,
yes,
it's we're using something that is vacant here in D.C., and that's common sense. Every one of those points that you describe is going to have a political fight associated with this.
That's true.
And that seems to be the stalemate. We end up in some sort of political chicken situation.
It is, but see, the only way you can come out of a situation like that, having worked with the New York City, this guy is a good example. They couldn't even sell bonds. They were in such a bad shape. And everybody on my team, I had 40 people up there. We were engaged by the Secretary of Treasury to figure out the financial, what was the financial condition in New York City. And I asked the 40 guys at the end of the 2 weeks when we issued the report to the Secretary of Treasury, do you think New York City can repay this loan? And not a hand went up. And they were all proven wrong. Because Governor Kerry had a monthly meeting, and he had everybody around the table, the unions, the bankers, the big developers, everybody that had contributed to the problem was now told there isn't coming any more money from the state or the federal government. We got to make some tough decisions. And that's what the president and the leaders of Congress have got to do. They've got to get together, and they've got to come up with a plan that is broken down by the major components of the U.S. government.
But Congressman Al, as a former seated member of Congress, those fights of making the tough decisions affect, unfortunately, your ability to get reelected in your district. Every one of those minute details becomes an issue of, will I get reelected or will I not be reelected?
I remember Speaker Jim Wright saying in a private Democratic meeting when somebody said, Jim, you're talking about raising taxes, you know, none of us will get reelected. And the speaker turned purple, he was so angry, and stood up and pointed and said, did you come here to get reelected or did you come here to govern? Now, that's easier to say than it is to do, but that's exactly where we are now. Mm-hmm. And as long as we're all working, here's a suggestion. I think that the political leadership of both parties should take its campaign experts and send them on a long vacation.
That's right.
Because what's happening with both parties, and it was happening, it happened to me when I was trying to negotiate with Guy Vanderjack on a very small little issue. It just, every time we'd go back to our hired guns, the paladins of the politics, they'd say, no, you can't do it. And they'd give you political reasons. They wouldn't give you policy reasons. What we need is to bring in the good policy people that both parties have and pay attention to them and stop worrying about the next election as much as we are.
But Alan, these sorts of tough political decisions elude everybody in D.C., whether it's the executive branch or the legislative branch. Is there somebody who can possibly stand up and make at least the initiative to try and accomplish some of these tough decisions?
Well, you remember, it was just over a year ago that the president and John Boehner came remarkably close to cutting what was referred to then and since as a grand bargain. And there would be considerable new revenue over a 10-year period and considerable modification in the spending path over a 10-year period. It fell apart in the end because these things, A, are really hard, and B, there was a feeling that there was some moving of the goalposts, if you will. But there has to be a collective judgment that the path we are on is not only unsustainable, but really dangerous to everyone's agenda, and particularly dangerous to the most vulnerable among us. And this is the key for Democrat buy-in. They are very concerned about protecting the safety net, but believe me, if we have 10% inflation down the road, the people who are hurt the most are not the rich guys. Yeah. They're the little guys, and they're the middle class. And at the same time, Republicans have this view that you can't just tax increase your way into the solution on the top several percent. It's not that Republicans love them. It's that they don't think that's the right answer. Well, if you get those two sides together, and I like the notion of having a big group. I don't think a big group works because people hear what happens in the meeting and then they go back and they stir up their folks.
But Alan, when we talk about
it's the president and John Boehner still who are the two key players in this.
Yeah, but Alan Moore, when we talk about we shouldn't have this big group, we've got 435 people that were elected to be that big group. Where's the shortfall?
Look, we can talk at length about the challenges of governing and government, but we know we've got far right wing so-called Tea Party types in the House. We've got left leaning liberal Democrats in the House. They're all from safe districts. They all feel passionately about what priorities should be and how government should work. They are not the guys who have to come together to cut the deal. The leaders cut the deal, and then they have to bring the others in behind them. It's not easy, but it's the way it has to be done.
Bob Hines.
When I suggested the president's got to bring some people into the room, I didn't expect to have a big crowd. I expect to have the two leaders in the Senate, and the two leaders in the House, and the president. That's not a big crowd.
Would you include Joe Biden in that crowd?
Sure. I'd include Joe if he wants to be it.
And the ranking people on the appropriate committees, perhaps.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, you've got, you know, see, I want Pelosi in the room so somebody else on the Democratic side can say, you're wrong. We can't do that. I want somebody in the Democratic side to be able to say to Eric Cantor, you know, we can't go that far. You need to
have the Republican side.
Yeah. So, I mean, you need to have a relatively small group, but you need to have people who are the decision makers, and there are more decision makers. Perfect example was what Alan was talking about. We almost had a grand bargain, but there was some moving of the goalposts up on Capitol Hill when the president went up there and when Boehner went back to his – when they both went back to their own side, there were some problems.
But Chuck, you know, we're talking about hard decisions on a part of the budget that is specifically set as non-discretionary spending. In short, we don't have a choice. We have to spend this amount of money. Is there a way that – or is there some sort of formula that is out there that we can actually convince the American people that when we say non-discretionary spending, we're going to have to make tough choices on that money we have to spend we can't touch?
Yeah. I think the American people understand this very well, that there's a huge problem with host spending. That's what spawned the Tea Party creation. Yeah. And so they would react, I think, favorably if you had the grand plan that made sense to them. And if you had, and you got to get back to strong leadership, you got to get the right people in the key areas. If you think about it, when Nixon became president, he inherited two huge problems, the Vietnam War and the inflation. I mean, farmers were paying 14% on their mortgages when Nixon came in, and so luckily he had Paul Volcker over at the Fed, and Paul did the tough things, and there was a lot of people got hurt, but in the end, the whole nation and everybody benefited by him getting on top of inflation, right? Mel Laird got us out of Vietnam and into an all-volunteer force and leveled the defense growth that McNamara had actually lost control of, and without Laird and Volcker, Nixon, I think, would have had a hard time getting reelected. But with those two, he won big in his reelection, if you remember. So you got to figure out what are your big areas. You got to get the right people there to lead that area, and you got to sell the grand bargain to everybody.
But Chuck, you know, when we talk about the people that Nixon surrounded himself with, yeah, and the success that he had there,
yeah,
we can go back, even back two terms. We had people like Alan Greenspan.
Got you into trouble.
Yeah. But back in the day, we were looking at it under the Bush administration, part of the Clinton administration.
Yeah.
He was part of the future of the growth of our economy.
Yeah. But see, Rubin was the key guy in the Clinton administration, and he was backed up by Panetta and Alice Rivlin and really a strong financial team. And they got on top. It was really amazing. We solved this problem once before. If you think about it, we took 10 years to get into trouble, starting in 81. Took us 10 years to get back to a balanced budget. And then 10 years, we doubled up and got back into a huge deficit. We can get out. It's not, this is not an impossible issue.
Carl Toob.
Wasn't Jack Lew part of that
yes.
situation too? And he's going to be Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah.
Treasury, so you might have a person who might be able to help do the same thing again.
Alan Moore, is Jack Lew part of what Obama's hoping to be the next round of the next 10 years getting us out of trouble, as Chuck suggests?
Well, I mean, Lou's a grown-up who's had senior positions now in the Clinton administration and the current administration, but he's not a miracle worker. He's not a genius on Wall Street activity. He is a budgetary genius, and he's somebody who the president trusts. I feel very comfortable with the thought of Jack Lew as a Treasury Secretary. I wanted to add, since we were talking about what went on during the Clinton administration, there were two other factors that were really important. One, what Clinton inherited, not that he wanted to, was some spending caps that had been put into place at the end of the Bush administration, and the late Dick Darman was the guy who really created this in the big budget deal. And nobody ever gives Dick Darman credit for the creativity of these amazing spending caps that in many ways tied President Clinton's hands from doing some of the things he wanted to do. At the same time, there was this internet bubble and stock bubble that fed revenues into the system. So we had two kind of historical accidents that helped bring things into balance. I'm just pointing them out as things that were part of the
No, I agree with you 100%.
That came forward. That
those were two very important parts. And, you know, we could go back to the Darman model. They took those out early in the Bush-Cheney era. There's no reason why you couldn't go back to that control feature that they put in there. And then I kind of always think that the American economy would develop a new area of great growth. In other words, my twin brother was with IBM. And if you think in the 50s and the 60s, it was just the basic new computer era. Then when we came to the tech area, as you say, the Clinton people really, that was a big advantage because all of a sudden we all had PCs and everything else and everything like that. But that's really been the history of the American automobile coming in. You know, in other words, I think we have a very dynamic private sector economy, and I don't know what's going to happen in the next 10 years, but I suspect there will be one or two growth areas developed.
Energy being one of them.
Energy is very good.
And a very key component of the president's agenda yesterday. Yeah. But Chuck, you know, we talk about all these people that are surrounding, you know, we have Jack Lew now coming in, Secretary of Treasury, former OMB.
Yeah.
We can go back and look at Timothy Geithner, very savvy, very well respected on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Hank Paulson was covering all, both budgetary and Wall Street, all connected. Is there a disconnect between what they might be telling the White House and what the White House is actually trying to implement, particularly in the Obama administration?
No, I think the Obama administration knows what they have to do, just like I think the leaders of Congress know what they have to do. It's really now a case of explaining to the American people what the real facts are in this financial area, in the budgetary area, and everything like that, and then getting the leadership in that cabinet room to agree that we're going to do it. And, you know, it might not be doable. In other words, 4 years from now, we'll be at $20 trillion and deeper in the hole. I'm not saying this is a sure-proof thing, but I'm just saying this is a plan, something like this, that is feasible if you got the right people working and recognizing. And I think the American people would more than reelect the people that brought this kind of a solution to
Congress for now?
We have said several times we need to explain to the American people. The best explainer we have got currently is Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Who can explain things in almost a miraculous way. I was wondering, is there anybody who is a Republican who can match him or could come along. What I'm thinking of is a television program, maybe on PBS, maybe something that would be on one of the networks. But a program where you'd have both parties sitting there explaining the problem and explaining possible solutions in ways that the American public could understand, and then have the congressional leadership and the White House and what have you move in right behind that and start doing some things.
Alan Moore?
There's nobody in Clinton's class, but the two people who come to mind is a Republican and a Democrat, and it's Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, whose Bowles-Simpson Commission did some really groundbreaking and important work. It's not everything; it doesn't have all the detail, but it was really an important piece of work, which people are looking back on now and thinking, gosh, maybe we should have tried to push that one across the finish line. Simpson's good, Bowles is good. As a combination, they're particularly good. In terms of sitting members of Congress...
What about Tom Coburn? Tom Coburn is very practical.
Coburn's a smart guy, and he's practical, but he's got a chip on his shoulder, which it's hard for him to conceal. But he doesn't have the stature, and people aren't aware of him. But he's very good.
Congressman Al.
I'm thinking in television terms now. I like the combination of Alan Simpson and Bill Clinton. Their style is quite different, and I think that's useful. But they all can speak clearly and can convey what they're talking about. Now, that's not to detract from Erskine Bowles, but maybe we'll work it out with the three of them in some way. But get somebody who's not in office who can tell you unhappy things and explain why they're necessary. Got to be balanced in terms of partisanship, but I would not think you would want sitting members of Congress involved.
Yeah. I would go with Mel Laird and Clinton.
You know what I think?
Is Laird up to it?
Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah.
Wow. Bob Hine.
I think something like Mel Laird or Howard Baker.
Yeah.
Or Jim Baker, anyone
Baker would be good.
Along with Simpson and Bowles and Clinton, and just the four of them, four or five people sitting around talking about it, understanding ahead of time, they work things out how they want to go. Something like that on a half an hour, just talking to the public and put it on the television, let people see how bad it is.
Good, but I think they also, you're going to need some production in this. You're going to need some graphs.
Yeah.
You're going to need that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To help people visually understand some of their art.
Almost an Al Gore-esque climate change type movie.
Bite your tongue.
Hold that thought. When we come back, we're going to take a break here. It's Happy Hour. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue to talk about this. And Chuck, I want to go to you first. Why is Congress hesitant to invoke Erskine Bowles and Toto? Hold that thought. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Stay with us.
Because they've got no guts.
Well, and also, if you think about it, Ryan came with that budget plan. I said.
Happy Hour on Backroom Politics is sponsored by Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street. Heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar tavern. Stay with us as the roundtable continues after we order our drinks, order our cigars, and get ready for the second hour of Backroom Politics. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
And it's happy hour here at Shelley's Back Room. We're going to continue our discussion of the financial issues facing the United States right after President Barack Obama's second inaugural address to the nation. We left off last segment, Chuck, with talking about Simpson Bowles with former Senator Alan Simpson and former administration official Erskine Bowles. Why is Congress so hesitant to invoke Simpson Bowles as written in total?
Well, I think the problem was that Congressman Ryan was working on his own plan, and when he didn't vote for the Simpson Bowles plan, they went in that direction, and Romney put them on the ticket, so they were going on a totally different direction than Simpson Bowles, thinking they were going to win a big political victory. They didn't win that big political victory. So going back and looking at that now, I think makes a lot of sense, whether they're willing to do it or not. I'm not sure.
But go ahead, Alan Moore.
Remember, Simpson Bowles created a framework. Yeah. They didn't write a bill.
Right.
They didn't write a 1,000-page piece of legislation. Yeah. They wrote a 100-page report that was filled with things that, when you added them up, would have made a huge difference long-term in our deficit. But every one of those things was a political challenge, as we talked about before. The whole idea was, if we put everything on the table and everybody gives some, maybe we can make this work. It's the kind of thing that a couple of people can make sometimes agree on, but when you start digging into the details of messing with Medicare, of messing with Social Security, of messing with income taxes, of messing with the defense budget, of messing with discretionary budget and food stamps and Medicaid, there's something in there for everyone to hate, and it's hard sometimes to see in all that hatred that there might be in the aggregate something that works for the common good. This is tough stuff. You need your leaders to rally around it and bring the troops in behind.
But Chuck, I mean, Erskine Bowles, Alan pointed out that Erskine Bowles wasn't a bill.
Yeah.
It was a report. But the reality is, what Simpson Bowles put out there was a blueprint. It was a framework.
It was an architect's drawing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Shouldn't that have at least compelled somebody to say, you know what, these two guys are right. This is what we got to do. We got to make the tough decisions. Here's the blueprint, how you guys work it out. But they just can't seem to get their arms wrapped around it, Chuck.
Well, but I think Alan is right. They're very fearful of that. And what you didn't have is you didn't have the leadership of both the Congress and the White House coming together to say to the American people, we've just got to do something like this, rather than to continue to add trillions and trillions of dollars of debt on our balance sheet here in America, which, if the interest rates start going up, you're going to have another $1 trillion expense item in your budget, and that means we'll be running a $2 trillion deficit. See? So this is really high stakes
poker,
you might say. And it's going to take real leadership. There's no question about it.
But I
understand, because I heard one of the Republican senators say at one of the dinners shortly after Simpson Bowles, look at fellas, a lot of us are going to get defeated if this gets put into real action. And, you know, what they've been doing, they've been working on legislative language for
that's
some
when
of the
we
Simpson.
Needed Jim Wright.
Good
point, Congressman. Now, Bob, why don't you have a comment?
That's the reason you have to do something about getting a few key players in the room with the president and sitting down and talking about what they can do and what they're willing to do. And the only way we're going to get to it, I mean, in effect, they're all going to have to agree to jump off the cliff together. And that's the only way to do it. And it's easier said than done, but it's the only solution we have. If we try to do it with who goes first, we'll never get any place.
Chuck Bowser first.
Yeah, well, see, one of the things why we're having trouble getting those people in the room and everybody understanding that this is the big cliff is that we can sell bonds. I mean, the rest of the world is willing to buy our bonds at very low interest rates and we can keep this game going. If they didn't show up to buy those bonds, let me tell you, everybody would be just like remember when the $700 billion got voted down, and all of a sudden they went home.
Mm-hmm.
And they came back in 2 days and couldn't vote fast enough. So the crisis is coming. It's a question whether you get ahead of the crisis. Sometimes you don't.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I want to echo Chuck's remarks there. In that, we don't feel the crisis yet these exploding deficits. We can still sell our debt at a remarkably low price, and we've talked about it around this table. How people still flock to America because everybody else is in bad shape too. So interest rates are historically low, and given the size of the deficit, it's just amazing that that's the case. We talked about, well, maybe one of the other credit rating agencies is going to lower America's credit rating, and you've heard me say, big deal. It happened before, and it didn't affect anything because we're still the best place to put money. That's not always going to be true. That is changing around us. But until you feel it, and people feel it with higher interest rates or in inflation, it's real tough sell for politicians.
Yeah, but by the way, we're waiting up on the big screen TVs here in the smoke-encrusted room of Backroom Politics. We are awaiting a press conference from House Speaker John Boehner. In the background is a huge sign behind him that says no budget, no pay. Big words coming out of the GOP. I mean, when we talk about all this, especially after the inaugural speech yesterday, Congressman Allen, are we in for all-out fistfight brawl on the Hill, particularly in the House, as a result of the aggressive agenda put forward and the fiscal crisis that we're looking at?
We've had it for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
You know? So the danger is we're going to continue having it. And we've been kicking ideas around here, you know, Clinton explaining and other ideas. I wish there were some people who were in a position to implement those ideas who were talking about it, because I think the American public is capable of understanding this if somebody will sit down and explain it in terms they can understand. And that's one of the things that most members of Congress can't explain.
Yeah, but Al, it almost seems like the American electorate these days, particularly over the past 2 years, have seen, you know, oh, we're getting to the cliff, oh, they'll strike a deal, and we keep getting closer and closer to that cliff. We all thought that there was going to be economic disasters after Standard & Poor's downgraded the credit rating of the federal government and the bonds. We thought, you know, we hear now Moody's is talking about it. We're hearing all this rhetoric, but the American people still say they'll get a deal. It's just the kabuki dance that they do.
Somebody's got to explain it to them, you know, and the media is not doing a very good job of it.
Bob Hines.
What we need is somebody like a Clinton or somebody, maybe two, you know, a couple of people, who say, okay, for Social Security, if we have the means test, what is that going to mean? It'll mean X. If we don't solve the problem, then we'll be broke and unable to make our payments to you by 2011, 2017, 2019, you know, whatever the number is, on Medicare. If we continue the way we are going to have to make the copays double what they are today. Instead of 20%, it'll have to be 40%. If you start saying things like that, and you're someone who people respect and recognize as a couple of two or three people who are knowledgeable and are out of active politics but are still very interested in things, then you could probably begin to get people to understand that our elected officials are going to have to do some things we are not going to like, but that's not going to be a reason to fire them. It's going to be a reason to thank them for fixing the systems so at least they continue to work.
Alan Moore.
I was, as we were talking about this, I suddenly realized who's the right Republican to sit with Bill Clinton.
Who's that?
And it's Mitch Daniels, the outgoing governor of Indiana, who has just taken over as president of Purdue University and out of government. But this guy ran OMB for Bush 41. For Bush 43. He helped put the state of Indiana back together. It was borderline fiscal disaster. He cut employment. He cut taxes. He opened up opportunities for business. And he treated the people of Indiana like adults. He talked in facts about what the problems were, and he was our favorite candidate for president or vice president, and it didn't pan out. But maybe there's a reprise for him to sit with Bill Clinton and explain these realities in ways that are tested with listeners, with the public who really need and want to be treated like adults and who can be told. I mean, we've said before, nobody wants to say to today's young people, hey, kids, you're going to have to work longer for less money for a less comfortable and shorter retirement. Wow, there's a happy message. But you got to be real. You got to be honest. And that doesn't mean it has to be a disaster. But if without honesty, we just blithely move along waiting for disaster to strike, and that puts all of us at great, great risk.
Bob Hines.
The gentleman who Alan just talked about, who was my first choice for the nomination.
Mitch Daniels, yes. Governor of Indiana.
Yes, as we all remember, I guessed wrong. He didn't want to do it. But he today, after doing what he did in Indiana over the last, 8 years, is the most popular person in Indiana. I suspect if he ran for a third term, I don't think he could, he'd probably get 90% of the vote, including Democratic member and union members, because he saved the state and everybody knows it. And he did hard things.
Congressman, now you got a question.
Almost everything I know about Mitch Daniels I've learned from Bob Hines. I don't know the man. How is he in terms of explaining, not giving a speech? That's, yeah. Clinton's one of those people that can give a hell of a speech. He can also sit down and just talk to you and make you understand it. If Mitch Daniels isn't a great speech maker, is he somebody who can talk common sense?
I think the
answer, and keep up with, yeah, with
Alan Clinton may be able to add something to this too, but I think the answer to that is when he started to, you know, take up the job of saving the state of Indiana, I think there are a lot of people who were concerned and were worried about it. But he made it happen, and I know part of it was he talked to people. He talked all over the state. He went every place. You couldn't go to a county fair that he wasn't there. And he spent a lot of time and a lot of effort, and people began to realize that, by God, this guy's right. Is that fair?
Yeah, he is at his best in explaining things. This is not your classic politician, tall, great-looking guy. He's short, ruddy complexion. He doesn't look like a politician, balding. He's a smart guy who treats people like adults and knows his stuff cold.
Well, I didn't ask the question in a negative way. I just asked it for information.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I'm just...
He's a plain-spoken Midwesterner, a Midwestern guy who just is able to connect with people. That's exactly what he is. I don't know if you ever worked with him, Chuck, but he's he's fabulous at this. He would be a marvelous partner of Mr. Clinton.
Right. Well, I'm beginning to see a television program hosted by, say, those two. And part of it would be Simpson Bowles making a presentation.
And maybe Alice Riblin and Pete Peterson.
This is all great. This is all fantastic. We've been talking about this TV show that literally is not going to happen. We've been talking about the great people that could convey this message to the American public, yet guess what? We don't see hide nor hair of these people. Something has got to give on this, and we don't see it. That's what's remarkable about this. Carlton.
Yeah, maybe instead of a TV program, if we could put together a list of people who could maybe form an advisory committee or something and suggest it to the president, the vice president, the speaker, and the people, and people who have done this before, like yourself and others, who could come in and say, look, this, you know, we've got a problem, this is where we are, and this is what we feel you have to do.
But Chuck, I want to go to you and ask, you know, the American electorate has seen the Gang of Six, the Gang of Eight, the Super Committee, the Uber Super Teflon Committee. It seems that the American people are tired of seeing, every time they see another committee pop up on CNN, Fox, or MSNBC, they throw their hands up in the air and they say, it's just more inside the Beltway, inside baseball. Is there something that either the president or Congress can do that will literally get the attention and saying, look, we're not just old people sitting around drawing a check. We actually are trying to govern.
Yeah, well, I think your description of the frustration of the American people with commissions and advice is exactly right. So maybe you need some kind of a program where the president comes on and maybe somebody on the Republican side and says, we've brought these guys here together tonight to explain to you just how serious our problem is and what are some of the major areas of how we should proceed, and then people would tune in.
The president is probably the one person currently in office who is not worried about re-election.
Yeah.
And as a result, you're really putting a heavy load on him, but he's the guy that can take the hits. Now, he'd be foolish to do it if he didn't have support.
Yeah,
you know, right. So maybe he's the guy to put an idea in Bill Clinton's ear on some way of explaining this to the public, television or some other way. But the president, somebody's got to step up, and you're not going to get it with somebody who is going to run for re-election.
No.
Is John Boehner willing to sacrifice his career to do this?
Well, the last person in Washington who did that was George Bush, 41.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, he's not in any health condition that he can explain it. I would have loved to see him. Bob Hines, you had a comment.
Well, think about this here. We're talking about how to get this happening. What if the president called Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell and Boehner and Pelosi to the office and said, look, we're going to have to find a way to get this started. I've got an idea. I want to do it, but I want to tell you about what I'm going to do. I am going to ask Bill Clinton and I'm going to ask Mitch Daniels, you know, sometime next month, that they have time to prepare, you know, get all their background to do this, and then if you guys all agree, I want you to know what I'm doing, but I'm going to do it. But I want that to be done, and then I am going to call the presidents of the three networks, and I'm going to say this is something akin to a presidential speech. You would carry me if I was doing it. This is a couple of people who are going to talk about the most difficult problem we have in the country. The members of Congress, leadership knows what I'm doing. They understand it. And I want you to give us time. We want to have an hour and a half. And I want the networks to just, I want to see if I can get everybody, every cable system, if I can get them. I want the world to see what we're doing and talk about it. And then the president is going to be able to get a reaction from it. If it works any good, if it gets any positive at all, that makes it easier for the leadership and the president to sit down and start talking around a table, four or five of them, that's all you need, four or five, figuring out what the broad strokes are and where we can go, and then you start writing.
Alan Moore?
I don't have any objection to that idea. I don't, however, think that we need a lot of new ideas. the president and John Boehner came close to a grand bargain. And before we get really complicated and pull a lot of others in, I myself, given the pressures of having to solve the sequester challenge and the continuing resolution in the next 2 months, I'd like to see the president and John Boehner, the two of them, again, give it one more shot. See if they could construct a grand bargain. Now, Boehner would have to talk to his folks, and the president would have to make sure that Pelosi and Reid were aware of what was going on, and McConnell would be made aware by Boehner. What I would love to see is a deal get cut and the president go on TV with the charts and say, here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing it, and then let Boehner say, that's right, we're all in this together, folks, and we are doing this for everybody. It's going to be difficult and painful and hard, but this is why. That I wouldn't give up on that before we started moving to a plan B, if you will, that would require a Clinton and a Daniels or whomever else. But I like those two guys. I just think that they came so close before, and they know what the deal is and what the large aspects of the problem are, that I'd like to make the first shot at those two guys again.
Bob Hines, 1 minute.
That would certainly work if somebody shoots Pelosi. Pardon my French.
No, we don't. Bob!
I'm being facetious.
Let me be clear. We are not condoning our... I don't need Capitol Police swarming on that.
I'm only kidding. What we need to do, I mean, the president would have to be willing to say to Pelosi, Nancy, I don't want your opinion on this. I'm just telling you what I'm doing. And he's never been able to do that yet.
Well, and Boehner is going to have the same problem
with
the Tea Party people.
Sure he is. And he's, it's exactly right. I mean, but the reality is it's going to be a hard thing to do, because in those circumstances, without the public pressure, the Tea Party and Ms. Pelosi are in a situation to stand firm if they wish to.
And see what happens in the State of the Union.
We will see.
That's the real opportunity for the president to paint in broad strokes the condition of the State of the Union.
And that's only a couple of weeks away, folks. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. Carl, real quickly.
With regard to Ms. Pelosi, who's a longtime friend of mine, I think you ought to get used to the fact that she's going to be minority leader for at least two more years. And who knows? She could even become speaker again. So she's not going anywhere.
Well, there it is. And we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about one of the other key agendas, especially with the developments happening today in Texas. One of the key agendas that President Obama has taken since his election and after his inaugural address yesterday is gun control. We're going to talk about that when we come back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
Shelley's Back Room. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. Congressman Al, to answer your question, whose piano was that? That was Duke Ellington and his piece called Janet.
You have an excellent taste.
Yeah, I like to think so. I like to think so. It's kind of old school. But want to change gears a little bit and talk about one of the other agenda items that the president brought out in his second inaugural address yesterday was the issue of gun control. It is an issue that continues to hamper and elude both parties, many special interest groups, whether it's the Brady campaign against violence, whether it's the NRA. There's a lot of players involved in this, and gun control is going to be a sensitive issue, particularly after the tragic events in Newtown, Connecticut. Just as of today, there was gun violence on a campus northeast of Houston at Lone Star College. What started off as an altercation between two people ended up injuring at least four people. This is after a week of shootings, accidental shootings at a gun show out in the Midwest. Gun violence after an MLK celebration in New Orleans. Gun control is going to be a hot topic in the coming year. So the question now is, when we look at gun control, who possibly wins in this? You've got the strong money behind the NRA, and you've got the strong political machine of the Brady agenda. Who comes out of this as being somebody who could actually get sensible gun control measures in place? Congressman Al, I'll start with you.
Who could do that?
Yeah.
I'm not sure this is answering your question, but one of the things that I think has been overlooked for years about the NRA, everybody talks about how much money they've got and their lobbying and everything, but any congressman can tell you that what really gets their attention are the members. The members of the NRA are kind of froth at the mouth kind of people,
yeah.
At least the ones that hold the extreme positions. So will we fight this out without? Can we fight this thing out in Congress without paying attention to some strategy for getting to the membership of the NRA? I don't know, because I'll tell you, meeting a mad gun owner at a public meeting back home is a very unpleasant circumstance.
Well, Chuck Bowser, I want to go to you. GAO, even during your tenure, even up until as recently as a couple of months ago, the GAO has written several reports about not just gun control, but it's the actual enforcement of the laws. The key agency that we look at here in Washington is ATF, and ATF, up until a week ago, was literally a rudderless ship. It had no direction. It had no set forth goals to meet. Is it a matter of gun control can be done through practical enforcement, in your opinion?
Oh, I'm not sure. In other words, one of the things that's always surprised me is that the police departments who have to go up against some of these people with these high-powered rifles
assault
and
weapons.
Assault weapons and everything like that have never come out strongly for legislation that would take away these weapons. And when I you know, the GAO is located over there near the wall of the
police
were killed every year, and I lots of times walked by as they were holding their annual ceremony, and it fascinated me. And just like the up there in that small town in Connecticut, I think it was the mayor that said if his policeman had showed up with that guy with all the art, he would have mowed down a few policemen. And so the police are outgunned today. The firemen are outgunned if they show up to handle a situation. And yet the law enforcement community has never come out against the NRA. I think one of the reasons is what Al is talking about. This is a very scary group.
But when the hand... Absolutely.
Yeah.
But when the handgun bill came up, it was the first time and the only time in my years in Congress that I voted against the NRA. And it was because I had practically every police chief in my district come to me and plead that they needed it to protect their people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that's something that will sell with the American public.
Yes. That's
But when we look at law enforcement, even today we have a fractional law enforcement community. You have a sheriff in Georgia, a sheriff in Oklahoma that says that even if these laws or these administrative orders are passed, I will not enforce these laws. I will not set my people out on a task to seek these weapons out. If you have law enforcement fractured, Alan Moore, is there a way that we can find a collective agreement on what should be sensible gun control?
Well, I think the issue the president has to decide is, does he want a political victory, a big comprehensive approach that will almost certainly fail, or does he want to find a few pieces of legislation around which there's a lot of support? First and foremost, even the NRA has in the past said, we don't have any problem with improving the background check system and doing something about the so-called gun show loophole. Now, it seems to me that that's an issue on which the president should jump and figure out how to do that particular piece. The limitation on the number of cartridges that can be
in a magazine or
in a magazine or a clip. That's another one where there's some level of agreement. The problem with all of this stuff is there's over 100 million guns out there. There are people, as Al talked about, who are passionate and distressed and angry and suspicious, and they are single-issue voters that politicians ignore at their political peril, which doesn't mean you can't vote against them from time to time. But the president is enjoying, I think, the buoyancy of this issue with a lot of his constituents. So does he shoot for the moon and package it all in some big proposal that will divide Republicans and anger people and take a lot of time? Or does he try to make some progress on some smaller issues that might make some difference and some help? I don't know. That's the challenge for them to decide.
Congressman Al.
One of the things that's always bothered me about this debate is that the so-called anti-gun side of this, I use that as shorthand because my point is they're not anti-gun. We have allowed the NRA to make this into an issue of they're going to take away your guns. I don't know a single person who wants to have some kind of improvement in gun control that has any intention whatsoever of taking away anybody's gun. And we continue to let the NRA say that without ever providing a
check and balance.
An opposition to the concept that we're trying to take away everybody's gun. That is absolutely not what the Brady Group or anybody else is for. They're asking for something that is quite reasonable, but the NRA, you know, comes in with they're going to take your guns and the Nazis did and all of that crap. And so the message of the gun control group gets lost in the scare tactics of the NRA, and we need to back up and explain our position differently.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I'm close to agreeing with Al. The problem is that there are always, like on any issue, there's always a few guys who say, hey, we want to put these limits, then we want to register, and then we want mandatory buybacks. There are a few people who say that. I don't believe that that is the consensus view of those who want some controls, but what happens is you have a few people who say, that's what I'd love to do, and that becomes the grist for inflating what the other side wants, even though it's not, in fact, reflective of the great majority.
Congressman Al.
He's absolutely right. And it's also true on the other side, and I don't know how you work it, but I have talked to members who are members of the NRA, who say, you know, I don't see anything wrong with this. It's not going to... I'm a hunter. You know, I haven't heard anything that will keep me from hunting. If I have to register my weapon, I'm not worried about the Gestapo walking into my living room the next day and taking my gun. They're quiet. They don't see any reason to stick their head up and get shot by their colleagues. But you're suggesting there are some extremists on the anti-gun side, and you're absolutely right. There are some people that don't know when they've got enough, you know, and you've got to deal with that. But also, there are people in the NRA who probably really don't care if you pass some of the things that are talked about as gun regulation.
Yeah.
No, there's no question about it. But we also have a situation where, you know, we look at the Second Amendment, for example. You know, we talk about the right to bear arms, and then you have the anti-guns that say, well, a well-regulated militia. You know, is this a matter of time where we look at, you know, possibly the Second Amendment and saying, look, we live in a modern world. We're not talking about flintlocks and muskets. This is a world where these weapons are accessible even to bad people, that we have to sit down and say, look, maybe it's time we review and reword the Second Amendment itself. Bob Hines.
I greatly doubt that we're going to change the language of the Second Amendment. I do think that it's possible, given, as you say, modern times, that we might find a way to deal with some of the egregious weapons that are out there. It seems to me that everybody says that there's no need for these maximum capacity magazines and automatic weapons that are basically military guns. I mean, nobody hunts with a gun that shoots 60 shots a minute. I mean, there won't be anything left of your deer that you shot. You won't even be able to find the antlers. I mean, you don't need it.
Yeah, but Bob, I mean, let's be real, though. What you're saying isn't going to get you an A-plus rating with the NRA, and as Chuck pointed out, they control the message in this
field. Well, listen, I think that there are a lot of people who think that it's you don't need that. I think within the NRA, now I don't think you're ever going to get them to become an organization, but I don't think that the NRA is as strong today as they were, let's say, a year or two ago before this rash of school murders has taken place. I think people are concerned about it. Because inevitably, the guys who come in to who are doing this, and it's all young men, you know, are not bringing in rifles. They're shotguns. They're bringing in these high-powered weapons that shoot a whole lot of bullets very, very quickly because they're not the great shots, so they just spray bullets around. That's all they're doing. They're just spraying bullets around over there at Newtown. That's all they did, go into a classroom and just start waving a gun around with pulling the trigger. But so it's a different kind of they're not the kind of people that the NRA wants to be a part of. The membership don't.
But Alan Moore, how do Republicans go against the views and the message that's being put out by the executive president of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre?
Well, we don't know what the president of the United States is proposing yet. He's talked about some of the things he wants. He's talked about some executive orders.
He had 23 points in his executive order.
Fine, those are executive orders. If you look at that stuff, it's pretty minor stuff. That's why it can be done through an executive order. The big stuff you have to do through change in the law. And as I said before, he can either try to really shoot the moon in a big bill, or he can say, you know something, let's increase the background checks. Let's close the gun show loophole. 85% of the American people say they're good with that. That means a lot of NRA people are totally fine with that. The NRA people say keep guns away from the bad guys, but leave us the hell alone. And so the question is how much do you go beyond that in a bill or bills? Until you know that, you can't even discuss what Republicans will or won't do.
Carl, hold on, Congressman. Carl Toobin, does the president shoot for the moon and put into place measures that Governor Cuomo did in New York?
You know, I think he's already been warned by people to watch out, to be careful. Remember what happened in the Clinton administration when they tried to do some tinkering with guns and or wasn't guns but taxes. And but you know, we have a different situation. We have a situation where these were children and a few adults, but mainly children. And Manchin has come out strongly for doing something. He went and talked to the governor of Connecticut. It was on camera on yesterday. There are other people, you know, et cetera, that are forcing this. I think that people are still afraid of the NRA and what they could do in the next election, but it's going to take a lot of courage on a lot of people to step up and to try to get something done in the Congress.
But I think that given that circumstances have given a possibility,
yes,
moving in with the primary message, we are not going to take away your
right.
guns.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And then talk about what you want to do, not trying to convince the NRA, trying to convince the average guy who is a sportsman or a target practice guy or a skeet shooter or something like that.
Well, let me also say, you know, the president has got his organization now ready to lobby the Congress and do grassroots stuff and lobbying the Congress. And this could be a big factor in this whole thing.
Bob Hines.
If the president is smart on this issue and doesn't try to go whole hog, I would think that he'll be able on things like huge magazines and checks, full checks. I think he's going to find some Republican members, not just, you know, the most liberal member in the House, but I think he'll find some pretty reasonable people who will say, this is reasonable, this is fair, and that will be a big, big help.
Particularly if he starts with, we're not going to take away anybody's gun.
That's a good
thing.
That's the same.
No.
We need to lead in with that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, but Alan Moore, we are talking about a president who originally everybody thought, oh, that's the end of owning guns in America. He actually took less enforcement action, had less policies, and was actually he himself was not pro-gun, but his lack of maneuvering was actually supportive of the NRA. Can he backtrack from that now? Do you think?
Of course. We've got events in the world that have happened. Newtown changed the nature of things, and the question now is, does he want to win on a few things? Or does he want to lose everything but win the politics? I don't know.
Chuck, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think the NRA has controlled the message for the last 15 years. And but the events now are starting to erode their ability to control the message. In other words, every night when you look at these TV screens and see one more shooting and everything like that. And what you've given the average citizen with an assault rifle or these magazines and everything like that, the ability like a machine gun in war. And so as long as they're out there, you're going to have one bad situation after another. And so eventually, if he could come up with a concise group of things that are possible and start making progress on it. I mean, he could declare victory. Not that it's a complete victory, but you know, you can move this along.
I don't think there is a complete victory because we're not
Right. Because we're not trying to take away all their.
No,
debt.
I think that's a good way to lead. Too.
Good point,
yeah.
Bob Hines.
We want to take the machine guns away.
I don't know whether the NRA has taken down that ad about the
president's
kids,
children,
which I think was about as stupid an ad as
right.
I have ever
right.
seen.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that hurt them.
Yeah.
It hurt them a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a again. I think if he goes for the moon, he probably will get less if he picks out some of the most egregious things and says, let's take care of those.
Yeah.
And I think if he's wise and does that, he'll get a good bit.
Yeah.
Right.
I think shutting
down these gun shows.
Yeah.
I think the vast majority of American people, because they don't go to as big attendance they get at these gun shows. That's the hardcore.
Well, you know, it's funny because you hear a lot of the pro-gun activists say, well, nobody's ever gotten shot at a gun show. And what we just saw was two events where people got shot at
gun shows,
just in one week.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Put that out there. Congressman Al.
I have told this story on this program before, but it's worth telling again to understand the mentality of the gun nuts as opposed to the gun owners and sportsmen and whatever.
Yeah.
And it was in a bar. And there was some guy who'd had too much beer. And he was saying, by God, you know, when the Ruskies come, I'm going to take all my guns up into the hills and defend America. And I stupidly said, I didn't know that 30-06 could bring down an ICBM. And
but
the guy came this close to hitting me. I mean, it was just so offensive.
But I do want to point out, though, that, you know, one aspect of this that we don't hear a lot of, but the gun activists and the gun lobby have a point is the Second Amendment wasn't just for sportsmen. It was to have and arm the citizens. Should a nut job get elected to the White House, or should government be taken over, that in fact, you know, citizens can form a well-regulated militia and have the ability to defend the constitutional rights that were given to them by our founding fathers.
Oh, get real. You know, if there is some kind of organized way of taking over this government, the sportsman and his 30-06 aren't going to stop.
It'll be like that ICBM from Russia.
That's right. Right. It's just,
so we'll take it down.
Bob Hines, you had a point?
No, my point is just what we've just heard. I mean, that's the reality is that the best thing the president could do would put a program forth, which so many of the people in the country right now with Newtown right in front of them, and these other, you know, we've had two or three shootings since then, the most recent one today. It seems to me that it's a marvelous time to be smart enough not to overstep and think you can go all the way. Just get it, universal coverages, worry about the gun shows.
Wouldn't a guy like Harry Reid, who knows the problem of losing five senators, be able, and he's been involved in this area, wouldn't he and a couple others be able to help the president craft a realistic program that could maybe get through?
I think they could.
And I think they ought to do it.
You're talking about something crazy like bipartisanship and consensus building, et cetera. That doesn't happen.
And the Republicans aren't going to want to be standing next with their arm around the guy with the assault weapon.
No, and Mitch McConnell's got a hell of a lot of folks who are hunters in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that they could solve some problems, if they deal with the stuff that is really serious.
Agreed.
Well, and I think you just said we wouldn't all want to go all the way.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what all the way is. We don't want to go all the way. All the way is, according to the NRA, taking away everybody's gun.
Right. Yeah.
We don't want to go all the way.
Yeah.
And nor are we going to be able to put in regulation that will prevent anybody from shooting somebody else. That is just not going to happen.
Well, we're getting news just in from our friends at CNN. They have just announced that General John Allen, who who is the top commander for Allied forces in Afghanistan, has been cleared by a military investigative board of all wrongdoing involved with General Petraeus and his autobiographer, and Jill Kelly and Broadwell Gate. So that's one less person taken out by the Tampa social mafia. So that being the case, that's a good segue into my favorite part of the show. And that's Tell Me a Story, where we talk about all the rumor, innuendo, buzz going around the Beltway that we sometimes get to scoop the media outlets with. Congressman Al, we'll start with you. Tell me a story.
I think the best story I could tell is the one I told just a little while ago.
Very good. All right, we'll give you that one. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
Yeah, there's been a lot written lately about the French government, which wants to take the maximum tax rate up to 75%. That prompted the famous
Gerard Depardieu
to say, you know something? I've been paying 62-65% of my income. I'm not going to pay more. I'm going to move to Belgium, and then maybe I'm going to move to Russia. Former President Sarkozy of France, there was a report in the last couple of days, is talking about possibly moving to London. Now, what I think is we're going to start seeing some of this in America, because in California, part of the Jerry Brown solution is a new top income tax rate of 13.3%. You add that in the state income tax, you add that to the 40%, 39.6% federal rate, plus the 3% Medicare tax that everybody pays, and you've got tax rates of 56%. Start watching for wealthy Californians, particularly athletes, Hollywood types, and business types, setting up residence in one of the 9 states in America that has no income tax, including Florida,
Texas,
and it might
Arizona.
Start even tomorrow with Phil Mickelson, the golfer, saying,
Florida's beautiful
I'm
this time of year.
Moving to Texas or moving to Florida. We'll...
And I also hear Caymans are pretty in the wintertime. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
It looks as though the immediacy of the deficit fight is over, because we're going to have a 90-day push down the road, and if the Congress passes what the House is trying to do, and the Senate as well, it will push it down. However, that means that in the next 60 days, we have a time when we have the a continuing resolution, which is at the end of March, and we have the sequester, which is, I think, middle of February.
Correct.
So it looks to me as though everybody who thinks the deficit fight is over on the floors of the Congress is in for an interesting several months.
It makes good radio for us. Carl Toobin, quickly, tell me a story.
I'll tell you a story quickly. First of all, it's the same story I was going to tell last week, but a little different thing. I want to commend the Secret Service for being able to get 40,000 people into the convention center. And I was listening today very closely to see if there was any trouble going in and out, et cetera. My story last week was I was going to sell tickets to go into the park opposite the convention center, so when the 40,000 were in there, to watch the walls come apart because of all the people there.
No,
but it didn't happen.
Did not happen. Absolutely not. My quick story is are you serious? Are you really serious? Story. Word comes out late last week that Congressman from Oklahoma 2nd District Mark Wayne Mullen, his chief of staff, issued a press release to every media market that would take it, saying that Mark Wayne Mullen is getting death threats. And the Capitol Police is upset wait a minute, you're not supposed to announce that, realm. You got to stop telling everybody about that. So needless to say, there's a lot of people asking, why did you press this out? Again, it's amateur hour on Capitol Hill. With that, I want to thank Congressman Al Swift. I want to thank Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Carl Toobin. I especially want to thank our special guest, former Comptroller General of the United States, Mr. Charles Bowser.
Here,
thank
here,
you
here,
very
here,
much.
Here.
It's always great having you here. Hope you'll do this again with us.
I'll be happy to sometime.
Fantastic. Yeah. Folks, we'll be here next Tuesday. Have a great week. Have a safe week. And politicians, let's be civil to each other. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Hey, folks, for those of you who are still on, well, I forgot a very important part of this. Number one, we didn't talk about the Beyonce lip singing. That'll be a story for next week. But we hope that you'll join us next week when we are broadcasting live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob, go.
The place to be.
Absolutely. Mission accomplished, folks. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Cutting me out.